Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Hey, it's Nerdist Podcast number 543. We've added a second show at San Diego Comic-Con, so Saturday, July 26th at 7:30... The 10:30 show sold out. We are doing another Nerdist Podcast live. Thank you if you've already bought tickets. And please prepare for a thank you in advance when you buy tickets. Ugh, that was a clunky way to get into that. But it'll be super fun, and guests will be announced soon. And we'll see you there. Comic-Con's, I can't believe it's already right around the corner. That's crazy. We were just there. What's happening, people? Shit's moving by real fast. Real fast. I would like to thank for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast, R-Tunes. It's an online music network, and essentially it will mix indie music alongside mainstream music. So you're going to get it'll not just play you the same level of artist. You'll get, you know, it'll figure out what you like and then kind of mix in new stuff. I mean, it's a fantastic music discovery program. There's tons of stations for your musical taste. Bigger song variety than Pandora, and you can sign up for free. Go to rtunes.com, sign up with the promo code Nerdist, and get 6 months of premium membership. That's unlimited listening hours, skips, no audio ads, and it's free on iOS and Android. So go. By the way, if you're an artist, you should sign up if you're a musician or a comedian, because the royalties they pay are more than any other streaming service. So gain exposure or discover new music while being exposed to new people and stuff that you already like. That's rtunes.com, O-U-R-T-U-N-E-Z.com. I'd like to thank you for sponsoring this episode of Nerdist Podcast, which is Alfred Molina, who's the freaking coolest guy in the world. Oh, man, he's awesome. I mean, you know, Alfred Molina's done a million of everything. If you listen to this podcast and you know that he's Doc Ock, you also know that he was in Raiders of the Lost Ark and a ton of other things that you would enjoy. And now he's in a show called Matador, which is on Robert Rodriguez's El Rey network. And Matador is essentially about a guy who is... this isn't Molina's character, but it's about a guy who's a soccer star who is actually also a CIA operative. But it sounds super cool, and the show premieres July 15th. And Alfred Molina has the best accent, and you are about to experience it. Smear it on your eardrums like the delicious clotted cream on top of a tasty British biscuit that it is. The Nerdist Podcast number 543 with Alfred Molina.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
I know there's a little comedy theater downstairs and this comic book shop which we've taken up residence in the back of.
Should I wear these?
Yeah, if you want.
They know you're here, right?
They never asked. We just started showing up. All right.
And then you got squatting rights and they can't kick you out.
We got some squatting rights. Yeah. Yeah, they were like that nanny.
Exactly. That is the craziest thing.
It's like the movie Pacific Heights. Remember the Michael Keaton movie?
I never saw that.
It was really good. Yeah. Melanie Griffith and Matthew Modine and Michael Keaton. And he basically moves in. They have this apartment building in San Francisco. Uh-huh. And he seems like this total nice guy. And they're a young couple. And so they don't really do a lot of formal stuff with him. Like, oh, he seems fine, you know. And he basically just comes in and starts using all these loopholes and tortures them. And then, of course, it turns into this really, like, messed up thriller. But it's a really fun movie, yeah, and he's really good in it. But we're here to talk about you, Alfred Molina. You know, what's interesting is it took years before I realized that you're actually British. It took years for me to realize that.
Yeah, well, I think that happens a lot. It's been a blessing and a curse in a way, because when I first came to live in the States about 20 years ago, I had a few films that had, you know, that were known here, but they'd all been movies where I was playing different nationalities, you know, different sort of ethnicities, and I think people made the general assumption that because my name was Molina, that I was maybe Latino or Hispanic, that maybe I was, and also I did a lot of stuff playing Americans, so the assumption was, oh, you know, maybe he's American with, you know, Mexican dad or something like that. And then, and I realized after a few years that I was going to these interviews, and I would start talking, and people would be looking at me slightly wide-eyed. And I thought it was out of, you know, a great deal of respect and adoration, but it wasn't at all. It's complete confusion.
Well, I think, you know what it was? I think I know what it was that doomed you to that, which was, it was Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah.
It was Raiders.
That's right. Well, that was the first one I ever did. And I was, you know, I was playing with a kind of sort of Latin American accent. And I think that was the assumption. I was this young kid from, you know, somewhere down south. But that's okay. The blessing has been that when I was at drama school, one of my professors actually described me as ethnically ambivalent.
I think that might be a compliment, because you could drift to a lot of different roles.
I mean, at the time, I thought, oh, that doesn't sound very positive. But that's basically what he was implying, that, you know, that there was a, you know, my name, the way I look, you know, the fact that I can speak Spanish and Italian because of my parents. You know, it kind of enables me into an area that has turned out to be very, very creative. I mean, I've got no complaints. You know, I mean, the fact that I'll never get cast in a Merchant Ivory film doesn't...
you don't know that!
Doesn't really worry me.
You don't know that at all!
But, you know, I was never British enough for the British, you know, and that was the nice thing about coming to the States, was that here I was just part of a much, much wider... sort of ethnic spectrum, you know. So it's been a good thing, really.
What do you mean? What do you think that you mean by Brit not British enough for the British?
Well, in Britain there tends to be, you know, people kind of curious about your name. They'll say, oh, where exactly are you from, Alfred? You know, and you sort of, because you sound, I sound English, you know, mm-hmm. I seem English, but you know, I've got no English in me. My, you know, Spanish father, Italian mother, they were both immigrants to Britain. So you're not quite British enough for the British, you know. And when I was at drama school, for instance, my full name is Alfredo, and that's the name I graduated under, and that's the name I was going to keep as a professional actor. And my first agent in Britain said, oh, no, darling, you know, you've got to drop the O, you'll be playing Spanish waiters all your life. Whereas in America, no one would dare say that to you. You know, no one would dare say to Benicio, you know, like Benicio del Toro, no one would say, you know, I think Ben's better.
Yeah.
You know, just say, call yourself Ben Bull.
Ben the Bull.
Ben the Bull. I think you'll be better. I think you'll get more parts that way. You wouldn't dream of doing it here, because, you know, here the acceptance of your ethnicity is so much more sort of, you know, wide-ranging and embracing.
When you stepped on the set of Raiders of the Lost Ark, were you like, what's this? A weird kind of...
No, I was terrified. I was very excited, as you can imagine, but it was, you know, my first movie. Steven Spielberg was already a star director. Harrison Ford was already a star actor. You know, this was an extraordinary piece of good fortune on my part. You know, my daughter was about to be born. We had no money. I was working in some tacky little theatre downtown in London. I was making no money. And suddenly this movie comes along, because in those days it was very cheap to shoot in Britain. You know, a lot of British American studios were coming over to London to shoot, because, you know, the studio space was cheap, the workforce was cheap, certainly in comparison to here. So all these British actors were getting cast in these movies, you know, like the Superman films, the Star Wars movies, Raiders. All these big productions were coming over to Britain, and we were kind of getting, you know, we were getting some nice little roles, So this job came up and I was thrilled, absolutely thrilled. And I knew nothing about movies. I knew nothing about, I'd never been in front of a camera. I was so green, I was getting notes from the carpenters. They were giving me, you know, they were kind of telling me. And the, you know, and I didn't know what a camera mark was. I had no understanding about focus or anything. I was moving around everywhere thinking I was doing the right thing. But it was a great, great experience. And it sort of, I mean, I always loved films anyway. I was a big movie fan anyway. Mm-hmm. But I never thought of myself as being a movie actor. I thought that happened, you know, to other people. And then suddenly I found myself working in films, and I just fell in love with it.
I'll tell you, a part of nerd vernacular has become throw me the idol, I throw you the whip. Like,
I
that,
know.
Like people just say that
I
now.
I know. It's really interesting that now there's, because I've been acting for so long, there's a kind of, I can now break down fans and people who are interested in what I do in very specific age groups. You know, there's people my age, maybe 10 years younger, who are kind of, you know, middle-aged guys are saying, throw me the idol, I'll throw you the whip.
Yeah.
Guys in their 30s are now kind of, you know, saying, quoting lines from Spider-Man 2.
Right.
You know, or even younger, you know, and it's really interesting that. And I love it. I mean, I've never had a problem with that kind of interest or that kind of attention, because I think, you know, I mean this quite genuinely. I think the fans, you know, the audience that will go and see a movie that they love 3, 4, 5 times, you know, and will buy the DVD, and then they'll buy the reissue, and they'll buy the, you know, the 25th anniversary edition, all that. That's the audience that keeps us all going. That's the audience that keeps the industry alive in a sense. And so I've got no, I never complain about it. And also, you know, their interest has enabled me to put 2 kids through college. So I'm not complaining.
I also, Species was a fantastic movie. I fucking loved that movie. That was such a fun movie.
Yeah, it was.
Do people still?
I mean, some people do. I mean, that was the first time I went to Comic-Con was with Species.
What year was that? 97 or something?
Yeah, something like that. And Comic-Con was nowhere near then. It was already a big deal, although I'd never heard of it before that. But it was certainly nowhere near as big as it is now. I mean, in the 90s, the studios would go to Comic-Con kind of almost reluctantly. You know, it was like taking a big chunk out of your working day. But now, it's totally the other way around now. I mean, one goes there with you. I mean, I remember going, the last time I was at Comic-Con was when Spider-Man 2 was released, and we went there to unveil the first image, the first new image of Doc Ock, which was the big, the big poster with the arms and, you know, sort of me looking over my shoulder. And it was terribly exciting. And you know, the producers announced this. They said, we're now going to show you, this is the very first public showing of this new, the image. And they unfurled it. And it was like the place went spare. I mean, it was fantastic. I mean, I was thrilled. I couldn't believe it. It was wonderful. I mean, that's what I mean. That's what I'm talking about. That enthusiasm, that love of the genre, that love of the material, which is very genuine, I found, you know, and it's fantastic.
So when you're looking at all the different pieces, because how many movies have you done at this point?
I don't know.
Can you even know?
I don't know, 70 maybe.
70, right? So when you sort of, I'm always interested to find out, like, how people define what success is. And I loved hearing you say, like, I have to put two kids through college, you know? Do you think that it's a certain level of, is it financial freedom, or is it like I get to do all these different things, or is it I'm still working, or I only get to do stuff that I like, or what? How do you define it?
Well, I think it's a bit of all of those things. I mean, I can only speak for myself. I mean, every actor, I guess, would give you a different answer. But for me, it was always to keep working, you know, to stay employed and to stay engaged as much as possible. And it doesn't always happen. I mean, you know, we've all done our fair share of stuff that we'd rather not be doing, but you know what? You've got to pay the bills.
The internet keeps it alive. You can't run. You do something, you go, no one will ever see this. The internet's like, I've got a different plan. And then there it is. Oh, man, why is that on Netflix? Ah, shit, that's on YouTube.
That's right.
Who would record that?
I know. I mean, you do stuff, you kind of go, on, yeah, no one's going to see this. And then next thing you know, someone's stopping you at some red carpet function with a photograph, with a still from that thing, and
right,
you know, and a silver Sharpie. Could you sign that for me? You know, but it's I'm lucky that I don't think I've done anything that I'm really ashamed of in terms of work. I haven't done anything that I would think I would really hate anyone to see this. There's been highs and lows, certainly, but I think staying employed and staying active and staying engaged, and now that I'm getting older, getting to work with younger directors and younger actors, that's really important to me now.
How long did it take before you felt totally comfortable, like walking onto a set where you go, yeah, no matter what they throw at me, I think I'm going to be okay?
I still haven't got there yet, to be perfectly honest with you. I think there's always, I certainly feel more confident now than I did when I was, in my 20s, but there's always a small percentage of you that's kind of thinking, maybe this is where they find me out.
It's people are always comforted to hear that people in your position still think that, because everyone always thinks, oh, when you get to a certain level, you're probably just like, but I think if you ever feel like you do have it figured out, you should do something else.
Absolutely. I teach a little bit now, and I always tell my students, if ever you have the instinct that you've nailed it, if ever you come to the point where you've come off stage or you come out of a take and you kind of go, nailed it, you're lying to yourself, because you never nail it. That's why we keep doing it.
And how do you even define nailing it? I feel like the idea of nailing it can mean a lot of different things. It can either mean I either did what I wanted to do, or that was really good, or the audience liked it. Like, it doesn't, I don't even know, like, what nailing it is really a sort of a subjective point
of
view.
Totally, yeah, it's completely subjective and completely unscientific. It's all about whatever your emotional state might be at that moment. But it's like nostalgia. Nostalgia is a very bad barometer of history, and the same way that feeling of having nailed it is a very bad way of judging how the event has gone. It's very untrustworthy.
I guess that's true, because how many times have you thought, oh, I loved this one movie or this one show when I was a kid, it was the best show ever, and you watch, you're like, what the fuck was wrong with me?
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, and what's really weird is how acting styles, how quickly they go out of fashion.
Oh my god, of course.
I mean, you can watch something from 15, 20 years ago, and you kind of think, and you as you say, you remember it as something really brilliant and vibrant in your memory, something that maybe moved you at the time, or maybe might have even influenced you to do something and change. I remember seeing performances when I was in my teens, which are the performances that made me think, yes, this is exactly what I want to do with my life. That's what I want to be. I want to be doing that. And now I look at some of that stuff and I think, what the fuck was I thinking? but that's not their fault. That's not the fault of the material. We all of us work in the context of our time.
Yes.
I mean, in 30 years' time, people are going to be watching movies that I'm in. They're going to be having conversations like this about it.
Well, of course, because in 30 years' time, movies will be about 4 minutes long, and the inciting incident will happen in 10 seconds, and then the climax will be at about minute 3.
That's right, yeah.
And then it'll just like wind down by
That's
minute
right.
4.
And then there won't be any actors in it.
No actors, all CG, and then beam directly into your brain. You will have the vague sense that you had a 4 minute experience and you're kind of meh about it. That's basically just whatever was going to happen. I always wonder, like, when the transition happened, like, who, and I know this is trackable online and someone will share this with me, but at what point in film did they stop becoming glorified theater pieces and people stop talking like this?
Yeah.
No one in real life talk like that. No one in real life talk like that. So how, like that sort of separation between this is a theatrical presentation versus but that's not like real life.
Yeah.
When did people stop going, I'm going to pop down to the shop now?
Yeah. Well, I think it was probably a gradual process, but I think there were certain sort of historical markers that where you can pinpoint where there was some kind of sea change. I mean, I think in the 50s, the whole advent of the Actors Studio in New York, that changed a lot when directors and actors were started to look for a more psychological approach to the work, and before that, a couple of generations before that, when people like Stanislavski and Sigmund Freud were, they were kind of almost contemporaries. Sigmund Freud was studying the underlying reasons for human behavior, and Stanislavski was doing a similar work, but it was all to do with finding the underlying behavior of the characters that his actors were working on. And trying to find some more realistic approach, and I think that they were, but it is a very gradual approach, because you can see movies like, I mean, let's, for example, you look at something like James Dean's three films, or the movies that Brando was doing at the time, Montgomery Clift, those actors who were in the late 50s, early 60s, were finding a really very, very real, very authentic approach to the work, not theatrical in any way, very kind of simple, very focused. But there were movies being made at the same time where that big theatrical style was still going on. You know, that those films didn't necessarily appeal to, Brando's movie, On the Waterfront, was not a mainstream hit. It was a bit of a cult movie. It took a while before that movie became recognized. I mean, it was a huge critical success. But, you know, Mr. and Mrs. America, you know, in the middle of the country didn't go and see it, you know, because it was too uncomfortable. You know, Jimmy Dean's films weren't huge box office. They became that later. You know, he died young, he became an icon and so on. But it takes time. You know, these things evolve over time, you know, and it's the film enthusiasts, the guys and the men and women who love movies purely for their own sake, who don't have a vested interest necessarily in the business of it or the creative side of it. They love movies. And it's that audience that, in a sense, becomes the arbiter of what's going to remain relevant and worthwhile.
Yeah. And so what did your parents do, by the way?
My father was a waiter, and my mother cleaned rooms in a hotel.
And did you go when you did you did you were you in drama in grade school or
I was in primary school, yeah, that's right. When I went to what we used to call secondary school, which was, you know, like high school,
yeah,
I was very lucky that I had a teacher, an English master, Martin Corbett, who I remained friends with until he passed away. My first day at school was his first day there as a teacher, and he was the deputy head of the English department, and he started a drama club. The school had never had a drama club. He started a drama club, and his brief was to put on two school productions a year. And he had been an actor. He'd had some experience in professional theatre, so he brought all that with him. And for all the geeks like me, you know, I was no good. I wasn't an academic high flyer. I wasn't good at sport. I wasn't popular with the girls in the girls' school next door. The drama club was like this little creative cave where me and all the other geeks went, and why it was so fantastic was because there we could be whoever we wanted to be. And he taught us all about improvisation. We used to do little scenes from plays. We would do acting exercises, vocal. It was fantastic. It changed my life. Totally changed my life. And that was really when, you know, that was really when the my mother used to say that I was 9 years old when I said I wanted to be an actor. I'd just seen Spartacus, and I think I came home and said something like, "I'm going to be Kirk Douglas." But I don't think at the age of nine,
mother, I'm going to be Kirk Douglas. Are you talking like that? Like, yeah, Jim?
I am Spartacus. No, you're not. But I don't think at that age I had any real idea of, you know, what was involved or what it entailed, but when I went to school and I met Martin and he, you know, it became, I can pinpoint it down to one moment. I said to him, I confided in him and said, you know, sir, I want to be an actor. And he said, okay, I'll help you. I'll give you books to read. I'll give you a reading list. I'll tell you what films you should see. He gave me this whole list of things to do. And then he said, but if you drop the ball once, I'm washing my hands of you. Which at the time scared the bejesus out of me.
Of course.
But it was like the best thing he could have done. Best thing he could have done. Because he was testing me. He wanted to make sure that I was serious.
Sure.
And if I was serious, then he was going to be serious. And he was. He was fantastic. And I was lucky that I had him as my English master and mentor till I was 18, till I went to drama school.
And how, as you're doing these exercises, I mean, I imagine, because I always think performers are forced to get to know themselves more than other professions, because you spend a lot of time asking what do I think about this and how would I react this way and what does this mean to me, especially as you're trying to delve into other characters. You're basically just digging around your own experiences and finding analogous ones.
I hadn't thought about that. That could well be true. I mean, I think there is a lot of analysis that goes on, but sometimes it can be dangerous because self-analysis can be a bit misleading. And it can be a bit self-serving if you're not careful. I mean, that's why we have analysts. You know, that's why we don't have, you know, sort of, you know, self-analysis classes. You know, you need an objective eye, and it's very hard. It's the most impossible thing in the world to be objective about yourself. But I think certainly in terms of the way actors will study a character or will analyze a character's motivations, certainly I think actors may have a way in to understand not necessarily their own behavior, but certainly have perhaps a deeper understanding of human behavior, maybe.
Yeah. And do you think there's anything else with the acting tools that you have that you think, well, if I didn't want to be an actor anymore, I could use these tools and go do this?
No. No, it's a totally singular set of skills. You can't apply. It's not like learning about kind of, you know, engine mechanics.
Right.
You know, it's a very singular skill set which is part of its charm, but it's also part of it's what makes it kind of limiting in a way. Because I don't know if I should admit this, but I actually can't do anything else.
Well, you don't have to.
Well, thank goodness I can act, because I can't do anything else. I mean, I've thought about it. I thought, what would happen if I couldn't act anymore? I don't know what I'd do. I really don't. I come here and work for you.
Would you? What? Well, you can still just do that.
I noticed they need an extra pair of hands on one of the counters.
I'll tell you what we need right now is the fucking air conditioning went down, and it's the middle of summer, and this room is usually not like this, so I apologize.
I'm all right. There's a little bit coming out.
It's not that. It's not much.
It's not like.
This is probably exactly what it was like to shoot Indiana Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Oh, that was a lot worse.
No. Okay. Good. Good. I'm glad to hear that. Are there types of films that you seek, or is it a let's read some stuff and see what pops, or do you go, I want to do this kind of thing to stretch in this way?
No, I'm very dull, really, in that way. I kind of like, I'll read whatever comes in, I'll read whatever comes along, and also I've never really been in a position where I could have such an array of choices that I could like just sit back and say, well, I think I'll do this one now. You know, I mean, I've kept in work, thank goodness, but I've never been inundated with scripts. You know, that doesn't really happen. But I mean, I've been lucky that there's, you know, because, you know, thanks to my ethnic ambivalence,
is that the name of your album?
Yeah, it's Ethnically Ambivalent, A Life in Film by Alfred Molina.
Sings the hits. If you're blue and you don't know, I'll too.
No, but I think there's been a reasonable array of choices, but it's whatever I like, you know. It's I got asked recently by a journalist, you know, did I have any, he put it in a very odd way. He said, did I have any regrets that I'd spent so many years acting, playing the bad guy? And I gave him this, you know, I said, no. I said, you know, and I told him, that's when I first said, you know, no, playing the bad guy has given me a very nice lifestyle, and I've put two kids through college. So actually, playing the bad guy has been a wonderful thing.
You know, that's a loaded bullshit reporter question. Like, yeah, hey, totally. I know you've achieved some stuff, but let me see if I can poke a hole in that and make you feel bad about something. Yeah. Like,
well, it also, I think it's also betrays someone who has a distinct lack of research, who, you know, just hasn't done,
of course,
the work. But anyway, the thing is, it's very easy to think that, you know, you've done very similar role. But that's every actor goes through that. I mean, that's not people like what you do. If they like what you do, then they'll like you to do it again.
I don't think Doc Ock was a bad guy in the way that you portrayed him.
Interesting.
He was a good man.
Yeah.
Who, I mean, the inhibitor chip.
Yeah, that's it. That's
he lost his wife. Come on, what's he gonna do? Of course, he's gonna fucking ravage that town. You know what?
You're absolutely right. He was a saint.
He was. Well, he was acting under the direction of some sentient arms.
He had a lot of stress.
He was very, very stressed. And, you know, quite honestly, Peter Parker was kind of a passive-aggressive dickhead. So it was not your fault.
Not my fault. I washed my hands of all blame.
Yes.
But that's what I loved about the Marvel comics when I was growing up, which is why I preferred Marvel to DC, was because the DC characters all seem to me, and this is, you know, this is like a 13, 14-year-old's head, they all seem to me to have a kind of like a moral point of view. They all seem to be a little bit too goody-goody. Whereas the Marvel characters, there was something really ambivalent about them. You know, they were all, even the heroes were kind of like reluctantly heroes.
They were flawed.
They were flawed, and they became heroes almost by accident. You know, the villains kind of had all kinds of issues. I mean, there was something, I mean, not that I was, you know, that sophisticated that I could see all the nuances, but there was something about them, plus the way that it was drawn. I mean, there was something really very, very different and edgy about the Marvel comics, you know, when I was growing up. I loved them.
Yeah. What characters did you...
Well, I was a big fan of Green Lantern.
Yeah.
I love Spider-Man. Was Thor Marvel? Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's Marvel. Yeah, I loved him. Yeah, I used to, you know, save up my pocket money and, you know, go and get the new comics. I used to love it. I loved it.
Well, and comic book movies have very obviously stated it really evolved since the. If you dig around on YouTube, you can find that 1970s Spider-Man movie. Where it's basically they've just tilted the camera on the side, and it's like, tune in, true believers, you know. And then it's like the shitty webbing, and yeah. You know, we really needed the technology to catch up,
yeah,
so that the superhero movies could not be like, look at that crappy kid stuff over there. I mean, they've really evolved, and really in just such a short, you know, in the last like 15, 16 years, really.
Yeah, I mean the revolution was digital, and the facility that afforded in terms of how you, not so much the stories themselves, but how you tell the stories, what was available in terms of how you can visually. I mean, and it's interesting that as digital technology became more and more sophisticated, this is just my opinion.
Sure.
The scripts became less and less sophisticated because there was less need for people to explain themselves.
Right.
Because you could see it all happening.
Yeah.
And you could see it happening in such a convincing and exciting and engaging way. You know, when you've got an actor climbing up what is clearly a plastic wall in a studio, you've got to give him a line like, this is hard. I don't know if I'm going to get there, but I got to, you know. Because you've got to sell it. But when it's clearly the hardest thing he's ever had to do, you don't have to have him explain it.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a kind of, and so the storytelling became very different, you know, it's very exciting. But the speed at which it's all happened is kind of scary. I mean, when we did Raiders of the Lost Ark, that, believe it or not, that, as far as the technology that was available, that was cutting-edge technology.
Of course.
In that movie. But Harrison was actually lowered into a pit of snakes. And those snakes were real. They kept like 3,000 snakes in two dressing rooms at Elstree Studios.
They must have had a good agent.
they stunk the place out. And a few escaped. They reckon there are still snakes in the woodwork,
You can kind of see in the one shot where he's looking at all the snakes, you can see a little bit of a reflection of a pane of glass.
You see a tiny shadow on the pane. That's right. But that was real technology, and that's what they had. That's the only way they had to shoot it. Whereas now you reshoot that scene, you'll have him lowered on a big, big green screen.
Yeah,
that's all that'll happen.
Yeah,
you know, and then everything else will be filled in, and they'll have so much more because they had to. You know, Steven had to rely on the snakes doing what they do.
Right.
He had no choice. Now he could give them all names and characters and addresses. I mean, you could just imagine. In fact, I think there's a good argument for remaking some of those iconic movies from that period. You know, that pre-digital period.
Yeah.
And doing them again with all the technology that's available would be amazing.
Well, I think they reissued a bunch of Star Trek original series episodes a few years ago, a handful of years back, where they did this really, they just did a light dusting of some of the effects with some CG. So in like wide shots of the Enterprise, they redid the exterior shots. And then when you're on the bridge, there's just some shit in the background that they just, it wasn't super in the foreground. And they just enhanced.
Did it make a difference?
It made such a huge difference. Like it to me, I mean, I don't know if maybe like really, really loyalists of the original show are like, don't ever touch the, but I think it just, it contemporized the show in such a way that you didn't quite notice it until you're like, oh wait, but it just worked so well. So yeah, these are these like, you know, these slightly enhanced as opposed to, you know, Mr. Spock is now CG. It was just little pieces here and there.
Yeah, yeah.
But there are some things. I keep saying, stop remaking the good movies. Like, go back and remake, like, Police Academy 4. Like, make a movie that really didn't hit it the first time. Like, those are the ones you remake. You don't go back and remake the hits. Because they already were done.
Yeah, that's true.
Once before,
I guess. Yeah. But I just think it might be, you know, when you think about some of those wonderful films, if they were being made now, it's just fascinating to wonder how different they would be, or maybe not.
I absolutely, you know, when Ghostbusters came out, that movie changed my life. And in Back to the Future, too. And these were movies that, you know, like really strong comedy films that had a really awesome special effects mm-hmm. team at the same time. And I mean, I would watch all the specials, like, how do they make the Slimer and how did they make the DeLorean do this? And, it, you know, like, they were forced to be creative. And I feel like now people, you know, it's not. When you have the resources, when you have all the resources at your fingertips, you're just not. You maybe some of the creativity.
I always think the most creative part is to make the science plausible. You know, you've got writers inventing some, you know, the name of some magic mineral that is going to sort of, you know, create sort of the ultimate weapon, and you know, you've got to create some kind of plausible science for it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Spider-Man 2 is a perfect example. You know, they're sort of, you know, they're trying to harnessing all that power into that little ball of titrium or whatever it was called, and just kind of, you know, it's got to work on some kind of level.
Yeah,
for an audience to buy it, you can't just say this is incredible stuff and it's going to, you know, destroy the world. So there's a lot of thought that goes into that, which may or may not have been there in a previous generation.
You know what's funny about Spider-Man 2 is that everyone was so fascinated by this like fusion ball that you were creating, but no one was like, did that guy just fuse some robot arms to his fucking spine? Like, no, that just sailed past everyone. Like, if you had just come out and said, look at these arms, everyone would be like, holy shit, how much money do you want?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
But it was like, that was such a secondary thing. That it literally fused to your spine, and you were controlling these arms, and but everyone's like, "Look at that ball of, look at that tiny."
But you know what sold it? What's up with, for me anyway? What sold it is that Sam Raimi gave it such a brilliant shot when, you know, you saw the spine, like, you know, kind of roll up my spine as it were and attach itself, and I'm explaining exactly what's going on, and then you see the hypodermics going in, and you see like 3 inches of something, and then you just see it disappearing into, presumably into my spine. That shot, just that single shot, sold it. That's when I watched it with an audience, that's when everyone kind of went, ah, you know. And such a simple shot. I mean, I wasn't even there for that shot. They just did it on, you know, they did it on the special effects guy's back.
Oh, that's cool.
I wasn't even there, and it was an, you know, just a quick insert. They needed something to just make it pop, you know, and it was just that zink going in, and you sold it. You just perfectly.
Was that John Dykstra's back?
No, I think it was like one of his assistants. I think.
Okay.
Yeah, and it was just fantastic. But the care, and I mean the care. I mean that's what blew me away about that movie. I mean, apart from it being, you know, the role of a lifetime, I mean it just the devotion to this form that this whole army of people gave, you know, is fantastic. And I was very, very proud to be part of that.
What have you learned? Like, what do you pick up? I mean, obviously they're all different things, but when you're working with Spielberg or Sam Raimi or anyone or a new director, you know, how do you kind of find your rhythm with that person, and then what what types of things have you learned from some of these people?
Well, I think it's you know, you're right. Different actors, different directors, you know, have a different way of working. They have a different approach, a different sensibility. But what they all share, what the good ones all share, is a genuine enthusiasm. You know, it's that, and I think that's what you latch onto. You latch onto their enthusiasm because that's what fires yours. You know, they it's their energy and their kind of love of what they're doing. And I think the best experiences are always when there's a huge element of enthusiasm involved. And you know, it doesn't have to be. I mean, and that can carry you through all kinds of, you know, problems and issues and obstacles. It's when directors are there just because, you know, there was nothing else to do, or, you know, you can spot it a mile off. You can smell it a mile off when the director's not 100% behind what he or she is doing. And it's very disheartening.
And what do you do when you're in that situation?
You kind of save yourself. You know, you sort of, you get in, I do it. I get into a kind of like survival mode. Just try and, you know, do the best you can and, you know. But it's very rare. It's happened very rarely. I mean, I've been very fortunate. You know, certainly on the big movies that I've done, it's always been, you know, because there's so much work involved. There's so much, you know, an actor gets involved in a film for, say, let's say a big movie. I mean, I from soup to nuts, I was involved on Spider-Man 2 for about 8 months. From the first costume fitting to the day they said, Fred, thanks very much, see you at the premiere. About 8 months. But before that 8 months, there was like 3 years of people working on the project,
yeah,
developing, you know, writing, getting the scripts, designing, you know, art production, you know, everything. All there's a whole world that goes on. So by the time you turn up as the actor, there's a whole army of people that have been devoting themselves to this for a long, long time, and you have to, you know, you have to respect that, and it's very exciting then, because by then, you know, like my first day at work on the film, they had an idea about giving it was not a good idea, but it was very exciting to try it. You know, house painters, mm-hmm, when they're painting a ceiling, they have these kind of stilts,
yeah,
that they strap onto their feet, and they've got a very wide base, so you can walk on these stilts very easily. You don't need to be like a circus performer or anything. You know, you just walk on these stilts. They're like, it's like tying big fat stools,
yeah,
to your feet. Well, we had this idea of giving Doc Ock some kind of height when he sort of emerges after the thing is after he's lost the inhibitor chip, and he's in there kind of going, I'll build it again, bigger, better, you know, all that stuff. We had this idea that I'd be on these stilts and I would just stand up to my full height, and, you know, and then we tried it, of course, and then when I tried to walk on it, there was no way of getting around this sound that kind of went chung, chung, chung. You know, it just, we couldn't kill that sound, so it just made the whole thing sound really awful. But that was like a whole day we spent on that, trying to solve that. It was really brilliant, you know, and I, you know, I was at Sony Studios in the special effects office, just kind of walking around on these things, kind of going, what do you think, fellas?
I don't think it's gonna work.
I don't think it's working.
How do you view the American accent? Because again, your American accent is flawless, and the different regional accents that I've seen you do are also amazing. So how do you? I mean, I feel like I understand how to flip into a British accent, but I don't know if I quite understand what our hooks are with the American accent.
I think for British actors, we have an advantage, which is that certainly my generation, when I was growing up in the late 50s and 60s, a good more than 50% of our TV was American. You know, we saw all the American hit shows, all the Western series, we saw all the cop shows, you know, all the primetime soaps, you know, Peyton Place and all that stuff. We were, in a way, kind of imbued with Americana, you know, the cars, the music, the accents, at a level where perhaps young American kids probably aren't when it comes to the British accent. I mean, I remember we used to play in the street. We used to play cops and robbers and, you know, cowboys and Indians, and we'd do it with American accents. We'd be playing and say, okay, I'll be the policeman, you be the guy, and we'd say, okay, yeah, I'll be the Lone Ranger, you'll be Tonto, and we'd do it with American accents, you know. and you'd be kind of going and stealing dialogue that you remembered from the TV shows. So we'd be going, head them off at the pass, you know, they're coming over the hill. You got me, copper. You know, all that, and it was all that stuff and it was just in our heads. You know, it was all around. So I think we kind of grew up with. Because I think most British actors I know do very good American accents.
I remember, I don't know how old I was, but I was like, one of my earliest memories was just doing a weird British accent to my parents.
I'll be the judge of how weird it is.
No. I'm not going to do it now. But I could have been more than like 4 years old, and I don't remember where I got it from. And I think they were like, "Where did you hear that?" And I'm sure it was just like, I mean, you know, when I was older than four, but when I grew up, you know, like a lot of the things I loved were like, you know, Monty Python or Doctor Who or the Young Ones or any of these, you know, like I loved British import stuff. So I. But at that age, I don't know, maybe it was a movie or something, and my parents, you know, like, I watched weird things. But I do remember thinking that it was a cool accent. And then in sixth grade, I got to play Oliver Twist in...
Very nice.
...the school play.
You see, you're more English than me.
I don't know if that's true. My mother is Italian, though.
Oh, my mother's Italian.
Yes. And you speak the Italian?
Sì.
Io parlo un po' di Italiano.
Anch'io?
Yeah, sì.
Che bene.
Sì, sì, grazie, grazie. questa ragazza è come si dice laughing?
Ha un sorriso.
Sorriso?
Ha un sorriso.
Ha un sorriso.
She has a laugh. She has a lovely laugh.
All right. Or she's eating sorriso, which is soy.
A very well-known Italian delicacy. I brought some with me just in case.
No. Well, you can find
I know you're a fan.
This room has turned into a smokehouse. So if you've brought any meats with you,
now's the
time to bring them out. I think we might be those meats at this point.
I'm drying fish downstairs. I don't know what you're doing.
Wait, is that a euphemism?
No. Okay.
All right. Oh, you mean literally downstairs. By the way, don't in a romantic moment say that to your significant other. I'm drying some fish downstairs.
Unless you're a fishmonger.
If you're a fishmonger, then someone will fuck
the
crap out of you.
A fishmonger's wife might find that very romantic.
Oh, look, you know, who's coming on to me.
Let's have less of the judgment value.
Let's see how dry those downstairs fish really are, then, should we? Sometimes
where is this interview going?
Sometimes
now?
My brain goes to I got to 15, and then that was it. My brain was like, "Well, this is the height of maturity that we should attain."
I think that's very healthy
for the rest of our life.
I think that's very healthy.
Maybe I don't know. Do you were you a big comedy guy growing up?
I've always loved comedy, but I never got cast in comedies. I was never perceived as a comic actor, although I have done some. But it's, you know, when you're large like I am, and sort of dark hair and bushy eyebrows, and sort of, you know, I can have a, you know, when I frown, I can look quite stern, you know. But you walk into a casting office, and they kind of the first thing people think of when they see my face isn't nice wacky farce for this guy, you know. They don't think that, but I love it. I mean, I've always loved comedy. I love comedians. I love, you know, comedy. I love comedy in movies, and particularly when it's you know, as you were saying earlier, when, you know, like movies like Back to the Future and
right.
Ghostbusters, you know, where the comedy is fused with something else, like a suspense or a sci-fi story. I think that's wonderful when it comes out of something else. You know, I'm not a big fan of like flat out slapstick comedy. You know, I mean, it's that's never intrigued me, because I always feel like it's the same joke. It's just the same joke over and over again, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I was never a big fan of, like, the American Pie movies, although I think all the actors in it were very talented. But, you know, how many times can you make a joke about somebody wanting to fuck a pie?
Right. Well, it turns out a lot.
Yeah,
it turns out.
I know.
Made a lot of those. A lot of... So I think there should have been a disclaimer in this one, in the credits. Many pies were horribly fucked during the filming of this movie. No disclaimer. <Yeah. laughs> There was a pie wrangler.
Yeah, no pies were harmed in the making of this motion picture.
Except for all the ones that got fucked, yes. But they enjoyed it. I was trying in defense of the pie. They liked it. You know, the pies...
Come on, they came on to me.
Seriously.
This pie came onto me. I'm just a man. I can't help it.
I mean, come on.
I have needs.
I'm a human being. This pie was begging me to pop its cherry pie. Damn it.
Here all week, ladies and gentlemen.
There's Izzy. Try the dried fish downstairs here at Fishmongers Comedy Club. Fishmongers need to laugh too, Alfred Molina. Fishmongers have a shitty life and they need to laugh too.
And who are we to deny them?
They smell like
who
fish all the time. They never get out of that. I was talking to a friend of mine once. This is spinning in a weird sort of philosophical way, but...
Nice segue, Chris.
Thank you very much. just about self-awareness, and sometimes you can get into conversations with people where you go, are they crazy or am I crazy or how do I know, like, who? And a friend of mine said, a fish doesn't know what's in water. And that saying always sort of freaked me out because it kind of makes me think, how do I know that I'm not the fish who doesn't know that it's in water? Do you feel like you have a fairly good – because you seem like just a pretty normal – cool guy, and not I don't mean this as an insult, you don't seem actory in any way, like you seem like a nice guy who just happens to be an actor. And so do you have that sort of self-awareness, or how did you develop that?
Well, I don't know, I've no idea how to answer that really, because I don't know.
Why are you such a good guy? That's a hard question to answer.
No,
but what is it that makes you sort of feel like that's work and it's fun?
Oh, I see what you mean. That's easy. I've always believed that there's a huge separation between work and the rest of your life. I do believe that, and I think that's very healthy, and it's something that I've always, believed in, and it's something I encouraged other people, you know, especially young actors who kind of, you know, young actors. It's very hard. It's very easy to get completely caught up in the work and agonize over it and maybe even sacrifice other parts of your life in order to service and to serve the work, which is very noble on one level. And I certainly did it when I was a young actor, but I learned very quickly that that's a one-way street, that, you know, you don't get any love back if you're a servant or a slave to it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can find a way of balancing the work with, you know, the rest of your life is the rest of your life. Your work is your work, and the work hopefully will facilitate the life. You know, when the work becomes everything, I think that's when, especially this kind of work, where, you know, a great deal of it is all about perception and rejection.
Yeah.
That can't be, I don't see as that being very healthy. But I think there's also an element of learning to find a way to not take yourself too seriously. I mean, I love what I do, don't get me wrong. I love acting, I love what I do, I love the people I work with, I love the milieu, I love the environment. I'm proud to be a member of the most wonderful tribe I could ever belong to. But we're not brain surgeons, you know?
Well, that sounds like a healthy upbringing, though, because, you know, what happens in this business is, you know, like I think anyway, what happens in this business is that, you know, some people, maybe I'm one of those people, I've been one of those people, it's, you attach your self-esteem to external things. If I do this, then that means I am good enough, or if I achieve this, I am good enough, or if I get this, or if I do this. And really, I think, you know, what it boils down to is, how do you just sit alone and be happy with yourself? How do you just go, this other stuff's great, doesn't define me?
But the thing is, you would have trouble doing that whether you were an actor or not.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a hard human dilemma, to find a place where you can be happy with yourself.
I wonder why that is.
I don't know. I mean, I think it's maybe it's to do with the complexity of the way we live. Maybe 100 years ago, maybe it was easier. I don't know. But I think that's whether you're an actor struggling with that is, I think, almost neither here nor there. I mean, I know lots of people who aren't actors who are having, you know, who are struggling to find some kind of equilibrium with what they do and who they want to be.
Right.
But I think it's, I mean, the great, I mean, I had this joke at work. I mean, I'm sure people are sick of hearing me say it, but I always start the day by saying, this beats hot mopping. However bad it is, however bad the day is, it beats hot mopping.
You don't have to stand out in the summer heat with a bunch of tar.
And, you know, it's, and that's the truth. You know, that's the truth. And that's a privilege, you know. I don't mean to sound like some kind of saintly, you know, altruistic sort of do-gooder. That's not at all. I'm as I'm as egotistical and as vain and as, you know, self-aggrandizing as anybody else. But there is, the truth is, this is a great way to live your life. You know, I mean, I'd rather be an out-of-work actor than an employed anything else. You know, and that's it. Just finding what you love, that's really the key, whatever that might be.
By the way, the follow-up album to Ethnically Ambiguous is This Sure Beats Hot Mopping.
Yeah, that's it.
That's the second. It's you with a hot mop and then a thumbs up.
The Hot Mop Tour.
The Hot Mop Tour.
I want to see that T-shirt with a whole list of dates on the back.
Alfred Molina's Hot Mop Tour. That someone listening will make that.
And it's a list. The list on the back of the T-shirt is all the various public conveniences around the country that the tour is going to go to.
The L train. It's all these different state capital in Austin, Texas. Yeah. You know, every place that you had to go to like hot mop a thing, you're on the road. As Jackson
Brown's.
he's doing
three nights at Port Authority.
Standing room only. We have to stand because I got to hot mop this area, so they can't have any chairs down. Jesus Christ, people, come on! This is what this is. Do you find that acting is kind of has any sort of relation to like a? Kind of just like a regular do it with your hands kind of job? Do you see any parallels between the two, or do you find them to be?
I don't know. I think there might be parallels in the sense of, you know, you have to get up to do it. You have to go to work. Sometimes you don't feel like doing it. Sometimes, you know, but I think that applies to anything really. But I don't see, I mean, you know, maybe it's just my lack of imagination, but I don't see any direct correlation between acting and, say, you know, running a business or you know, or, you know, I mean, I was going to say almost what you do, but then they're going, but what you do is actually in a sense a similar thing, because we're all involved in the business of show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that doesn't really apply, but you know, but I think it's all to do with, I think where the similarity is in your attitude to the work, in your attitude to what you do. You know, if you can come to work with enthusiasm, with a commitment, with hopefully a sense of enjoyment and pleasure and being happy to be there, then that's half the game, I think.
So you're working on you're working on Matador.
Yeah. That's right, yes. I'm in Matador and I'm having a wonderful time. It's we're just over halfway through our first set of episodes for season one, and it's been going really well. It's very, you know, it's interesting. It's for a new network, and so there's a kind, and it's cable, a new cable network, El Rey, founded by Robert Rodriguez.
Yes.
And
he's nice. We've texted back and forth.
He's
before.
Great. He's great,
like
Robert.
A good guy.
Yeah, he's fantastic, and he's very inclusive, very generous. He genuinely is very interested in what other people think about what's going on. I mean, everybody. I mean, he'll take a note from the craft service guy, you know, if he thinks it's worth, you know, the trouble. And he's got he's got this great setup in Austin. You know, he actually confided in me that when we were shooting the pilot episode, which he directed, he was a bit frustrated because when he makes his movies, he operates the camera, he edits, he writes it, he directs it, he's in charge, he even does the catering on occasion. He's totally hands-on. Here, he was just directing. Everything else was being looked after by other people, and he was finding it a little bit, you know, because he would play his guitar in between takes. He'd be playing his guitar on the set. And I said to him one day, I said, do you always do it? He says, oh, man, I've got nothing else to do. He was kind of really,
do you need anything? You want me to go on a run? No, you're the director.
But he's fantastic and very enthusiastic about this material. You know, he's really committed to the show. And there's talk that he might come back to do, you know, maybe the final episode of the season. So, you know, he's very much our go-to guy. You know, he's kind of set the tone. And that's the exciting part of doing a series for, you know, doing the first season. You're finding the tone of the show. You're part of that creative exploration of it, you know, so it's really exciting.
Yeah, and a lot of times I think that, you know, obviously because you want things to get picked up that you like, you know, that's always fun, but it's also the idea of, I hope this gets picked up again so that I can come back and apply all of the things I learned the first time around. Because there's always such a It's always such a steep learning. Next time, I really want to try this.
Yeah. I mean, and the nice thing about this particular group of people is that those conversations are already happening. You know, we're discussing about where we think it could go in terms of storylines, in terms of how we develop the characters and so on. Yeah, and that's the great advantage of cable.
Just for people who don't know, what's the story of Matador?
Well, it's got absolutely nothing to do with bullfighting.
What?
Just in case.
So Ben the Bull is not in it?
Ben the Bull is not in it.
The Bull?
He was far too busy. So basically, it centers around a young, up-and-coming soccer star who plays for an L.A. franchise, the L.A. Riot.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's called. But he's not.
We had one of those.
He's not just a football player. He also works. He's an agent for an undercover department of the CIA.
Nice.
And they are, and he's been kind of placed there to get intel on a guy who happens to be the owner of the team. That's me. Who is also the front man for a small group of very powerful, very influential, very rich individuals who are using their influence and their money and their contacts to manipulate events and world governments and events around the world their own nefarious profit.
You've just made soccer exciting to me.
Well, there you go.
You've just...
My work here is done.
Are you watching the World Cup or your World Cup?
I am.
Who are you?
Well, Italian mother,
right.
Spanish father, mm-hmm. born and raised in England, mm-hmm. now an American citizen.
Mm-hmm.
I had to watch all my options slowly fall away.
Maybe this one. Damn it.
Or maybe this. No.
God, you had so many chances. You bought like 5 lottery tickets.
That's right. Yeah, I don't know what the score of the USA-Belgium game was today. So.
Do you know what it is, Katie?
It was 2-1. Yeah. They lost in overtime.
USA lost?
Yeah.
So are we out of it now?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, we're out of it. Yeah.
Oh, that explains why no one on the street seems to be concerned at all. Traffic's just moving along.
I get into arguments with American friends of mine because I always say, why is American football called football when they never use their feet?
Yeah,
they kick the They kick the ball once.
Yeah.
Or twice, maybe. They should call it throw ball.
They should call it throw ball.
And give us the word football back.
Well, I notice you said soccer, so you've either been in this country a long time.
I've been corrupted.
Do you see what we've done to you?
You see, America's ruined me.
It's completely ruined you. You probably say, like, bathroom.
Yeah, I do. I say tomato.
Mm-hmm. Damn it.
And I say...
I say tomato.
Do you?
Yeah.
That's because you're pretentious.
Well, let's call the whole thing off.
But I go back to the UK now, and I'll say, you know, I really fancy going to see a soccer game. And all my English friends kind of go, oh, soccer, get you.
That's what it's called. Do you find that when you go back home, you purposely... here's why I'm asking. I'm from the South. I was born in Kentucky. I grew up in Tennessee. When I go home, I sort of automatically sometimes start talking a little bit more like, y'all want to... Like, I don't have an extreme drawl, but I definitely feel myself being pulled into it more
Yeah.
Hey, I'm still...
When you go home,
do you...
Yeah. I mean, I don't think my accent has changed that much, although my daughter, who still lives in London, she says sometimes you sound... She says to me, you know, Dad, sometimes you sound very American. And I think it's because of certain pronunciations.
Go to your room. How dare you talk to me like that?
There are certain pronunciations, certain sentence structures that I'll use. I mean, like my T's have gotten very soft. And I use the word gotten,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is very American. And my T's and my D's are softer. So, you know, instead of what was once dirty or city is now dirty.
Right.
City. You know, and she hears that and she kind of goes, oh, Dad, you sound really American. But when I go back to the UK, it's not too obvious, I hope, but I'm conscious, same thing as with you. I'm conscious of just leaning on it just a tad, as if somehow the subtext is, I haven't really changed. I'm still the same person.
Just don't push too hard. Yeah, hey, you bastards! What has happened to you? What's happened to you?
They just get reeled like Python. Whoa, yeah. My! I forgot what it was like to be British.
That's true.
I just go really high.
Noticed that a lot of Brits who live here, a lot of my British friends who live here, we do become more British than we ever were in Britain.
Make up.
It's like I find my whole attitude to making tea has now reached the level where it's here, where it's almost a fetish. Whereas in England, I didn't give a shit. You know, I'll stick the tea bag in the cup and pour the hot water and that's it.
Well, what is it now?
It's like, oh, no, warm the pot. You know, the tea must go in before the milk. You know, it's all kind of becomes a big kind of mishigas now, you know, and that's just, but I think subconsciously it's just a way of sort of hanging on to something.
Yeah.
Not wanting to quite, because for the first year that I was living here, I went totally native. I spent a whole year in shorts and flip-flops.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't wear anything else.
Fanny pack?
Yeah, you know, almost.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
I was at the last vestige of the fanny pack. You know?
That could also be construed as German.
Well, only with Birkenstocks.
Okay, good. Okay, but, with socks on.
But because everywhere I went dressed in shorts and flip-flops, it was totally acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like anyone said, I'm sorry, sir, there's a dress code.
Yeah.
You know, it was all fine. And so I thought, and the weather, you know, I've spent a whole year. Not in the same shorts, I hasten to add.
Oh, good, okay, good.
But, you know, just wearing like really kind of, like I've just walked off the beach.
Yeah.
And I loved it. You know, and I was drinking iced tea by the gallon, you know, never had iced tea before in my life. And I couldn't understand why I kept wanting to go to the bathroom.
Yeah, you're not supposed to. Your tea drinkers don't guzzle their tea.
No, I was. And this whole thing of like, you know, free refills. You mm-hmm. can imagine. I was like, I was kept thinking, I love this country. Look at this. You know, some free refills of everything.
Or ice. Do they not put ice and stuff automatically?
No, we're the Brits, we're very ambiguous about ice. You know, it's a bit of a cheat. It's like, if you put ice in a glass, it means you're not getting the full.
It's being diluted.
Yeah. So we're a bit, I mean, there was a time when I was growing up in London where you go into a pub and you ask for a drink with ice and they all looked at you as if you just crawled out from under a stone.
Get us on the rocks. What? Get the fuck out. You stupid. They just literally just drag you out. And then four soccer hooligans kick the shit out of
you.
Yeah,
that's right. Don't you call it soccer.
Football hooligans kick the shit out of you. You just made the beating worse. Soccer hooligans, what? And then they just hit you.
Well, now you're asking for it.
What? You really just want to get that shit kicked. Bite your face off. That's fucking fun. I love England. I think I might be going back there in August. I might go do some stand-up shows there.
Oh, fantastic.
I love it. I really, really, really love it. It's so nice. I don't know. I feel really connected to England in a weird way.
Oh,
my
great.
My dad's side of the family is some kind of English mutt.
Yeah. Now that's an interesting cultural phenomenon that American comedy, and by definition American comedians, have always gone down very, very well in Britain, but for a long, long time British comedy and British comedians didn't translate well, and I think it was the Pythons that kind of broke that.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of broke that glass wall, if you like. Because a lot of their humor was so physical,
mm-hmm.
and kind of just silly, but since then, you know, TV shows, comedy shows have done well here. But there was for a long, long time. I remember when I was a kid, there used to be a variety show in English TV called Sunday Night at the London Palladium, and the top of the bill every week was either a really famous American singer or a famous American comedian. And I remember seeing people like, you know, Red Skelton doing a 20-minute routine and going down gangbusters. People loved it. You know, I can still remember one of his jokes. He said, ladies and gentlemen, so great to be here. So great to be here in this historical building and on this stage where Henry VIII once said, forget the divorce, I got a better idea.
But those guys, like those kind of like vaudeville guys, they could, like, they were performing for essentially like what was, and I don't mean this in an insulting way, but like the lowest common denominator. So they were doing the most human stuff.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Not trying to, you know, as you start going up the ladder of comedy, it's like, how much more academic can I get with my comedy? And I think that even though we even though we speak similar languages, the cultural subtexts of our languages are so different.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That it, and also, you know, frames of references and things that I think...
Well, so much of British comedy is based on class. It's based on that kind of one... It's based on that kind of... Which is comedically a very rich vein, which is that sort of typically British passive-aggressiveness, which, you know, we've honed it down into a fine art.
Yeah.
And it infuses all our creative work. I mean, plays, movies, comedy, music. It's all, you know, it's all subtly in there, and it's a rich vein of material. But that isn't quite where American hot humor is. American humor's a lot more specific in terms of, you know, you identify the target and you just hit it, you know, and you hit it for all it's worth, and you hit it for as long as it stands up until it collapses. And the joy is that recognition, whereas British humor has this extraordinary way of, like, beating around the bush, you know, and kind of like going around the houses a little bit before you kind of hit it on the head,
and letting the tension build that
way.
Yeah,
I mean, they both are just as valid as the other, but there are cultural differences that comedians and comedy writers, you know, exploit mercilessly, which I think is great.
But we also get the added benefit of being delighted by British accents, which also adds to the comedy for us as well. I watched the thick of it, the Peter Capaldi show,
because
he's about to take over Doctor Who, which is a show that I love.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, he's becoming the new Doctor.
Wow, fantastic.
And one of the first things he says in this series is he's talking to somebody, he says something like, that's going to go over like a marzipan dildo. and it's just the way, it's this aggressive Scottish... But if someone here said marzipan dildo, people are like, what are you talking about? Like, the idea that he's even referencing marzipan, I don't know, it's just so funny. But sometimes we need the accent to, you know, to, like, to activate the joke.
Well, it's true. And also, you can get away with so much. I mean, I did a talk show a few years ago, and I knew I was going to be on it. So I think I told you this story the other day. I checked out the show, you know, for a couple of nights before I went on it, just to see what the style was, what the tone was. And there was an American, a rather well-known American actor there, you know, he's kind of plugging his new movie. And he was telling a story about something, it was very funny, and he used the word asshole.
Mm-hmm.
But when he told the story, the word asshole got bleeped. And I thought, oh, okay, so they're a bit careful about that. I went on two nights later, and I think I used the word arsehole, and it didn't get bleeped.
Did you say arsehole?
Yeah, arsehole. I said it with your
accent.
Yeah.
That's just one of those cute British colloquialisms.
I know. It's like suddenly, you know, arsehole is fine. Asshole.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, there's lots of things. Like, to us, you're automatically more charming. Like, you get 10 more charming points just because everything just sounds like it should
and
be.
Don't think for a minute that Brits don't exploit that absolutely.
You
up to
should.
The
You should, because
that's part of the passive aggressiveness.
I don't think we get that.
I heard a wonderful story about some American actors who were filming in a country house in England, and the lord and lady of the house had cordoned off certain parts of the building where they didn't want the crew and the actors to go in, and two of the actors were trying to find somewhere just to lie down because they were exhausted, and they just went into this room that had a cordon around. They thought, oh, you know, no one will know. So they sneaked in, and they fell asleep on these sofas. And after about an hour, they suddenly hear like this kind of coughing. And one of them opens his eyes, and it's the lady of the house who says, "It would be so lovely if you weren't here."
No, that doesn't mean you have to leave.
Oh, it does. That's like a perfect example of that kind of that British.
And it almost could end with dear.
Yeah, almost. Yeah, it was the use of the word. It would be so lovely. That's what, because you're lulled into, yes, I'll do it. Yeah, what would be so, oh, I see.
That would be lovely.
Yeah, no, here we should be like, get the fuck out. What are you doing?
Exactly.
You're not supposed to be here.
Exactly.
Get out.
Didn't you see the sign,
yeah.
Asshole?
It'd be real, or if we said it that way, it'd be really lovely if you were not here at the moment. Yeah, I know. We're a little direct.
Yeah.
It's not hard to spot an American in
But that's what's exciting about America. That's what's exciting about American art, American movies, American music. It's that direct link between what you think and what you mean and what you say. It's exciting. It makes that's why I think American or English as it's spoken in America, why it's so much, it's such a much more muscular version of the language,
because mm-hmm.
it's got this kind of toughness. It's got this, it's chewy. I can't think of anything. I can't even. It's got a toughness to it, and I think that's why when Americans curse, it's got a drama to it. There's a rhythm. It's kind of sexy. I mean, there's an energy to it, you know, and I think it's no accident that for years and years and years, successive generations of British rock stars sang with American accents.
Oh yeah, yeah, that
you know, that's no accident.
Really, I always thought that I could never figure out why.
Even the ones that try not to, they end up doing it. It's something about. You know, it's something about the rhythm of that, of the way the language is used in that way.
I wonder if that was conscious. You know, if they were hearing American rock and being inspired by American rock,
it
was just sort of conscious.
Yeah, I mean, you listen to any of the early Beatles, even the late Beatles recordings. They always sang with American accents.
And then the Sex
Pistols. I want to hold your hand.
Yep.
You know, it's not I want to hold your hand.
She loves you.
None of that.
There's it. Was it Peter Sellers, I Want Money? Or what did he say? What Beatles song did he cover?
Oh, Peter Sellers?
Yeah.
Oh, he did Hard Day's Night.
Hard Day's
but,
Night.
He, but he did it as a send-up of Laurence Olivier in Richard III.
Hard Day's Night.
Yeah, he was sending up Laurence Olivier. It was very funny. And that was a number one hit.
Oh, my God.
That tells you the state of British rock music at the time.
But British radio was so like...
A comic actor... with a number one hit single, doing an impression of a classical actor playing Richard III, but reading the lyrics of a Beatles song. That was the state of British rock music.
I think he really appreciated it because he seemed like a happy, well-adjusted guy. He seemed really...
Peter Sellers?
It's so funny that he existed in a time where, you know, he could be completely off his rocker, but... no one would really know.
Well, because he was some kind of genius.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, that's something else that we've learned from America, which is that, you know, aberrant behavior, difficult behavior is often forgiven because, you know, the work is so brilliant or so spectacular.
Right. You know? Although, you know, when Hugh Grant did that thing and he came over and sat on Jay Leno's couch and was like, I'm so terribly sorry.
Yeah,
But
with that accent, he was instantly forgiven.
Yes, of course.
And mind you, Jay Leno did him the biggest favor.
Oh yeah.
Actually, you know, the first thing he said was, "What were you thinking?" Got a huge laugh. Totally softened the moment.
Right.
It's not like, you know, it's not like he didn't get the Barbara Walters treatment. Like, you know, so why did you do that, or what do you think? What made you? You know, there's none of that. He sent him up beautifully right from the get-go, and it was fantastic. It was such a. I remember. I mean, and then he just said it was. I think he said something like it was a moment of madness, and you just felt the whole country kind of going, oh,
who hasn't been there? I mean, maybe not there exactly. That was pretty extreme, but who hasn't?
It was just up the road from here, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, yeah, I think it was just right around the corner from here.
Yeah,
yeah. They should put. There should be like a dark walk of fame where it's just like all the fucked up things that have happened.
Yes.
Just these weird black stars.
That'd be brilliant.
That's the tour. That's what we're gonna do, guys.
I'm gonna phone Mayor Garcetti right now.
Please do. He'll take your call.
Yeah.
That's a great idea. So when does Matador premiere?
Matador premieres July 15th. And we're on the LRA network, which is and if anyone has any trouble finding that, they can go to LRANetwork.com, mm-hmm. and you can find out wherever it's playing in your region.
July. That's right around the corner, arseholes.
Right around the corner, arseholes. Yes.
I like to put the R in it. I like to say arseholes. I like to be like an American who's trying really hard to be British because it somehow makes me more interesting because I can't achieve that just with my own actions and beliefs.
I have to say, before you said that you were from the South, that you were born in Kentucky. Did you say?
Yeah, I was born in Kentucky.
Kentucky and raised in Tennessee.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have known.
Really?
Yeah. I wouldn't have known.
Because I don't have that. I do love the accent down there. I feel very...
Did you make a conscious effort to lose it or to kind of damp it down? Or did it just evolve that way?
I think we did shuffle around a lot. We did travel a lot when I was a kid. And I did watch a lot of... I was addicted to comedy, like stand-up and comedy. And so I was so focused on television and entertainment and comedy that I think I just started... Because sometimes... I'll pronounce something and I'll be like, where did that come from? I mean, like, that's nowhere, anywhere. But I think it was just from traveling a lot. So I didn't get that drawl that everyone has down there, which is real nice. They add a lot of syllables to words. Like, they'll put a syllable
in it. It's very beguiling, I must say.
It's very beguiling. It's nice. Like, it's really nice. But it's also, you know... I always wanted to be able to hear the different... I can hear some of the different regional British accents... the same way that I can hear the American accents, but it's not like I can sort of make out what Welsh sounds like, but then everything else is just sort of like, I know sort of this British up here, and then this down here. Like I know those, but I don't really know what's what regionally, like why people.
I had a wonderful moment in the South when I was driving through the South from Miami to LA. And, we spent two nights, in New Orleans and, the last morning we were there, we got up early and we went to a diner, my wife and I, and this very, very sweet waitress, you know, she clocked our accents and sort of, said, say that again. just say that again. And I was kind of, and then she asked me if we had any questions on the menu. And I said, yes, what are grits? And she said, honey, what is grits?
Nice.
And I said, okay, what is grits? And then she just said, grits is grits.
That's the most philosophical.
I fell in love with her. She was like,
you guys sounded like you had this amazing accent orgy. Loving your accents and you were fascinated.
And Texas,
by hers.
In Texas, we had this, we got stopped by a policeman, highway patrolman, who, had the most wonderful, real kind of. He was like out of central casting. I mean, he couldn't have been more typical. I mean, and huge guy, took ages to get out of his car, and then finally came up to my car. And the first thing he said was, I'm not sure if I'm doing the accent right, but it was kind of like, is there some kind of medical emergency going on?
It would be lovely if you were not here right now.
But I loved it. It got me thinking about all those regional accents. And it made me think next time I get cast as an American character, I've got to find out specifically where he's from, because the differences are so huge.
Yeah,
that there's always a danger that you do a kind of generalized accent, which is going to be very frustrating for an audience. You know.
I think it only, like, if you were just playing a quote Southern guy and you were like, hey y'all, what y'all doing? Like, I don't think people would go, he's doing this. But unless you were from that area, I think most people just sort of get.
But I've heard different regional differences in the blanket definition of Southern.
Mm-hmm.
There's, you know, I mean, you hear things like, you know, the Carolina accent is very different from Alabama,
Georgia.
Very, it's all very, very. You know, there are. Very not so subtle differences either. Very, you know, very clear differences. And there's one accent, I don't know where it's from. It might be one of the Carolinas, which every now and again sounds incredibly English. It sounds very close to English. There's a kind of no. There's a kind of sort of, you know, I don't know about that. I mean, just a certain, you know, phrase or a certain sound which sounds incredibly British.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, because a lot of them, you know, popped over. Some of them. you know, came from like the, I don't know if it was Ireland or Scotland. I think maybe Scotland, like the hillbillies, were basically like Scottish imports, and they kind of moved to the mountainy areas of the South, you know, like the Appalachians or whatever. And
that's right. There are pockets apparently on the eastern seaboard where the accent that, and you know, anthropologically speaking, the accent is as close as you can get now to what would have been spoken in England in the 16th century.
Oh my gosh!
Because the root of the accent is the way that the first British settlers spoke. So when they arrived there in like, you know, in the 1600s or 1500, late 1500s.
Would it be recognizable today, or is it
well,
too...
Well, I think it's... They kind of did a study of all the different kind of sound components that go into the language.
Mm-hmm.
And they compared it with what we know about how English was spoken in the Elizabethan era and the Jacobean era. And the connections were enormous. You know, so there's a... I mean, I don't think it sounds exactly like it would have done, but it's an interesting leftover from that, you know.
If I understand my history correctly, and I learned a lot of history from watching cinema, it's that the British accent dates back to the Roman Empire, where everyone spoke with a British accent.
That's right. That's everyone. Right, yes.
It's funny that that's evolved right. to denote these people of
that's right.
Roman
that's right.
and the noble.
Yes.
It's so strange.
Good morning, Martius Lucius. How are you?
Oh, all right.
Yeah, that's right.
How are you lot?
But even today, you know, when you think about it, I mean, whenever like the villain is being cast, you can almost guarantee that it'll be a British actor.
Are Brits offended by that in
no,
any way?
No, you're
okay,
kidding.
Good.
You're kidding. It's a very you know, those of us who have played villains in American movies and are British, we belong. It's the way I see it. Anyway, we belong to a very noble tradition.
Because it usually just means like that's the smart guy.
It goes right back to the beginning. I think there is something about the accent, the otherness of the accent. I mean, there's not so much now, but maybe. But I mean, there was a time when name almost any movie from the 40s and 50s, and where there was an out and out bad guy, and the chances are it was a British actor.
You guys are good. So, England, does it bother you that you've built your career off playing bad characters?
Does it bother me?
No, I'm asking you the question the reporter asked you, but I'm now asking the entire country.
No, I put two kids through college.
Good. Well, it was wonderful talking to you.
Oh, a real pleasure. Thank
you. And I'm excited to see Matador, and please tell Robert Rodriguez I said hello.
I will do,
tell
of
him
course.
I said hi. Did he ask about me? And thank you for coming to our comic store. And hey, I hope to see you around.
Oh, well, I live just up the road.
Oh,
so,
good.
You know, I'm a neighbor.
I'll be over. I'll swing by.
Great. Great.
Okay, I'll get some of that. I'll get some of that tea that you really are really, really, really serious about.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I don't share it.
Oh no, you can't. You can't. Don't even look at it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not even going to tell you where it is.
Where's the tea? No, fuck off. All right, enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Thanks.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader, too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.